A busy old day on the radio and plenty to catch your ear. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran and here's what you might have missed.
And can I ask you, if you had to get those implants, that particular type of implant here, how much would that have cost you here?
€36,000.
€36,000?
Yes.
And you say you got it done for €7,000 in Turkey?
Yeah.
I was always the obese, the fat friend. You know, I was always, I could never shop in a regular store. Like, I always had to get a seatbelt extender on a plane. All of that's gone now. I have the sense of freedom, a sense of relief. I basically feel like I unzipped myself and walked out.
I mean, every Sunday we'd head off on the bikes and coming back and they talk about nothing else, only engines and pistons and rev limiters. And I think that was my actual nickname, the rev limiter.
And we'll start on the live line. Leanne called Katie about travelling abroad for a surgical procedure.
Leanne, you got in touch with us with, I suppose, what we'd call a cautionary tale. You want to warn people of the risks that you are taking on if you are considering travelling abroad for a medical procedure.
Yes, I am indeed.
OK, take us back. You had surgery in Turkey last October, was it?
Yes, the 26th of October.
OK, so explain to people, what surgery did you travel for?
I went for the gastric sleeve surgery.
And maybe just explain to people what that is, Leanne.
The gastric sleeve surgery is where they take 80% of your stomach and you're left with 20%.
Right, so you had an issue with your weight?
Yes, yes, and I was very overweight.
Right. And because, I mean, taking away 80% of your stomach it's a very, very big operation. That's a massive surgical procedure. So you must have been, I mean, you must have put a lot of thought into that before you decided to go ahead with it, did you?
Yes, indeed. Months and months I was thinking about it because I tried every diet. So I thought I'm sun, moon and stars to lose weight. I was losing weight and then I was putting back up weight and I thought it was just my only option to do was do the surgery because I did see people that had got it done and had lost a lot of weight and looking fabulous. So I said,
but
okay.
What were you concerned about health-wise at the weight you were? Can I ask you just roughly, you don't need to give me chapter and verse, but what kind of weight bracket would you have been in at that stage?
Before I went, I was 16 stone, 10 pounds.
Okay. So overweight, obviously, but wouldn't have been at the high end of people who maybe would be recommended for this surgery.
No. Well, it would in a way because of my health issues, I was on the verge of getting diabetes.
All right. And this was a worry for you, was it?
Sorry?
This was a worry for you. You didn't.
Oh, of course. Yeah, 100% it was a worry for me. 100%.
And, okay, so you're trying to think of your options. Did you look into your options at home first?
Yes, I tried Slimming World. I tried other various diets myself, going for walking the whole time. I did lose weight, but with the COVID and lockdown, my weight just went back up, went back into my old eating habits, like getting Chinese, like eating crisps, like just snacks. And I didn't realise how much I was eating and I was constantly eating.
Sure, we all went down that road to some degree, Leanne.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people will be familiar with that or will relate to that. But anyway, you found yourself last year thinking about surgery.
Yes, I actually booked it the 1st of March last year.
And when I say like, did you look into options for surgery at home?
I did indeed, but the price of it was just, no, I could not afford it. It was like nearly, it was gone up to about 14,000 now or something to get it done here. And I just didn't have that kind of money to be paying for weight loss surgery, especially when I'm only working part-time, so I wouldn't have the opportunity. If I saved probably 5 years down the line, yes, but I just wanted it done.
Yeah, God, it's a lot of money, all right. And yeah. I presume that's if you go privately, obviously, but I presume there's waiting lists if you want to do this on, you know, through the HSE.
I believe there's about a 10-year waiting list now for this.
Right.
With yeah. the HSE, yeah. That's what I believe.
And did a doctor recommend that you do it?
Well, I went to my GP and I just said to my GP, I had it booked and everything. And I just said to my GP, look, I'm after booking it. It's all booked and I'm going. And he just said, look, don't worry. I'll be there for you when you come home. You know, I'll give you the, I'll look after you. My GP is fantastic now, I must say.
But as you say, and, you presented him with the fait accompli. You'd already booked.
Yeah. Yeah.
And where did you find out about this Turkey, the place you went to in Turkey?
It was all more hearsay, and then on Facebook, you know, the hospital kept popping up on the ads, and like if I went onto Twitter, it was coming up based on Instagram, and I was going, okay, and then I was looking through all the photographs, and you see before and after, and you're like, oh, wow, this is amazing. They're saying it's only 6 months, it's only 7 months, and you're looking and going, I wish that was me now. And I got depression about my weight, and I didn't feel good in myself. And I was saying, look, this is it, I'm going. This is what changed my mind.
And you didn't go alone, did you?
No, four of us went over.
And all of you with the same, getting exactly the same surgery?
Yes.
And can I ask you, like, when you were on the way there, were you perfectly happy with what you were doing? Like, did you have any qualms about it?
No. I believed I was going over there to get the surgery done, and that was it. I was excited, going. I was nervous and excited.
And Katie asked Leanne about the financial costs involved.
And was it expensive, can I ask you, Leanne?
Well, the surgery, because I was able to haggle with the lady the coordinator that deals with the surgery. And I got it for $2,400 each.
Oh, because you had a job lot, basically.
Well, because there was a group of us going over.
Yeah.
She gave us, yeah.
You got a group discount.
Yes.
Okay, so $2,400 each. And did that include the trip, or was that extra?
No, that was separate. We had to pay for our own flights after that then, which was $400 return.
Okay. So $3,000 and you're covered, basically, for your trip. Okay, so you're on the plane, you go over there. What's it like when you get there?
When we got to the hospital, we had no interpreter, which I believe they told us that we would have. And so we were told, they were speaking Turkish to us, and I was saying, sorry, we're English, you know, English speaking. Mm-hmm. And they didn't know what I was saying. So I had to use Google Translate to them to show them that what we were saying, like, and that we had booked in and whatever. So they gave us a load of sheets to sign. But we didn't know what we were signing because we'd no interpreter with us to read it out to us.
And, like, how much of a kind of a wraparound service do you get? Was there somebody there at the airport to pick you up? How did you make your way to this clinic?
No, there's a guy there with a plaque saying with the name of the hospital. So they now, in fairness, coordinator gave us great details, gave us a picture and everything of where he'll stand, and gave us details on how to get to him from when you land in the airport, house, what way to walk up and what door to exit and everything, which was brilliant that way.
Okay, but as you say, there was a bit of a lost in translation issue once you got to the clinic.
Yes, very much so.
Okay, so and were you getting nervous at that point?
Yes, because I was saying, how are we going to get through this? Like, because we're English speaking, we don't know Turkish. They're not English speaking. But when we got to the wards, they have some English. So it was okay when we got off to our rooms.
And Leanne spoke about the difficulties she's had after surgery.
Was there vomiting involved here?
Yes, after surgery on the Tuesday, I was vomiting all day, and Wednesday I was vomiting.
And they were telling you this was normal?
Yeah, and I was vomiting up blood, and they were saying, it's okay, that can happen after the surgery. So on the Friday, they took out my drain, and then the blood just started pouring out of me. And I called the nurse, and the nurse came in and just started put pressure on it and said, that's okay, that's okay. And she just put a bandage on it and she said, it's fine. So I was like, but that shouldn't have happened. And they were like, no, that's okay, that's okay. So we flew home on the Saturday morning, but I felt very cold.
Oh, sorry, can I just ask you, your friends, yeah, the other three friends that were with you, how were they getting on at this point?
They were flying it. They were getting on fantastic. Absolutely, walking around the place and brilliant, where I was thrown down in bed.
Right, okay. So you're on the flight home, they're all grand.
Yeah, and I felt very cold. I was shivering with the cold, and they were like, Leanne, we're not one of us are cold. That we actually find it very warm. And I was free. I had my own hoodie on, and two of the other girls gave me theirs, and the other girl gave me her one to put over my legs. I was freezing cold. And I just didn't feel right. I was cranky, and I just thought it was from being tired. And then coming down on the bus, I was starting sleepy. I got home on the Saturday. I felt okay. When I got to bed, I felt okay. Sunday, I was okay. Monday, I was fine. So I felt fine. And come Tuesday morning, I went to stand up to go to the toilet, and I collapsed. And I went to the University Hospital in Limerick, mm-hmm, and went straight to resus. And when I got into resus, my blood pressure had dropped to 48 over 27, so I was obviously critical then. So they rang my partner to get out of the hospital. Obviously, in my thoughtfulness was to say goodbye to me, because when he came in, he was quite upset. And he was like, you know, he didn't know what to say to me, because he'd literally minutes to get out of the hospital. And he was only in with me literally for 2 minutes to say goodbye. And I was rushing to see her, because they had done a CAT scan on me, mm-hmm, while they were waiting for him to come, and discovered that my spleen had been cut and I'd internal bleeding, and I'd lost most of my blood, a lot, nearly all of it basically. And all my blood had concealed in my stomach, which led to sepsis, and my body had gone into sepsis shock.
That's Leanne on the live line with Katie Hannan. And in the morning, Dr. Maria van Kerkhove, infectious disease epidemiologist with the WHO, was shedding some light on the monkeypox virus.
Monkeypox has been identified in the UK, other parts of Europe and North America. Well, for more information on all of this, I'm joined now by Dr. Maria van Kerkhove, who's infectious disease epidemiologist with the World Health Organization Emergencies Programme. You're very welcome, Dr. van Kerkhove. Thank you for joining us on the programme. I want to come to monkeypox, because people are quite alarmed by this. What do we know about this? How serious is it? How concerned is the World Health Organization?
Well, monkeypox is one of the pathogens that has been on our radar for many years. It's a priority pathogen caused by an orthopox virus. It's endemic in a number of countries in West and South Africa, and there are a number of cases that are reported there every year. Mainly, people are infected through contact with animals, so zoonotic transmission, we call it, transmission between animals and humans through contact with those animals, rodents, primates, etc. In the past, we have seen some exported cases from endemic countries in Africa into other countries, such as into the UK, into the US, for example. And typically that happens quite rarely, but it is possible for that to happen. What is being reported right now are a number of cases of monkeypox in countries, in a number of countries in Europe, and also now in the United States, without those travel links. So we are trying to expand our understanding of the circulation of this virus, this monkeypox virus, which typically is transmitted between people through contact, physical contact with lesions, with open sores. And so we're working with a number of countries to identify who is infected and, of course, to prevent onward transmission and make sure that they receive the appropriate care that they have. So what is happening right now is that it's a little bit not typical from what we had seen in the past. And we are able to describe what we are seeing. And the reason I say that is because we are consciously looking for individuals who are seeking care for an unexplained rash, for example. And so we're able to describe the reports of monkeypox through laboratory testing. And so we're going to work with countries to expand that to see if there's any further spread of this and make sure that we take the steps to prevent the onward transmission.
And we're hearing and reading that the cases that are being reported are amongst gay and bisexual people. Is there evidence that it's transmitted sexually?
No, there's not. So we are identifying cases among persons who are visiting sexual health clinics. It mainly transmits with contact between individuals, which can include sexual contact. But we're not seeing this as sexually transmitted, like a new sexually transmitted infections. And I think that's really important. We don't want to stigmatize anyone any further. And what we are able to say is what is being reported. So far, the cases have been reported among groups of men who have reported to have sex with men. And these are individuals who have identified at sexual health clinics. But again, we're going to work with countries to expand surveillance to determine if there are any others that are infected with unexplained rash. Health workers, for example, or anyone else who has a rash that has not been diagnosed with other known causes of rash.
And many people recover, don't they, in a few weeks?
They do. Yes, they do. It's typically a few weeks where they have these open sores. There could be fever. It could present as respiratory infection. But the hallmark of monkeypox are these open sores.
Which sounds dreadful and very painful.
It does. It does. There are some treatments that are available. And so we want to make sure that those people who need those treatments get those right away.
And how concerned are you about the spread of monkeypox?
Well, I'm an infectious disease epidemiologist, so I'm always concerned about the spread of any infectious disease. We're concerned for two reasons. Number one is we have endemic situations in countries in West and Central Africa. There's very little attention paid to monkeypox because it isn't something that is necessarily perceived as a global risk. But for us at the World Health Organization, we consider this a priority pathogen, and much more emphasis needs to be placed on understanding transmission patterns, making sure that we advance on our antivirals and vaccines and have robust diagnostics to prevent the spread in endemic countries. We're also, of course, concerned of any potential spread to non-endemic areas and further spread, especially in areas that won't recognize or don't have monkeypox on their radar. But I work in pandemic preparedness, epidemic preparedness. And so what we want is countries all over the world to be ready to be able to detect cases when necessary and offer appropriate care to prevent onward spread and ensure that patients get the care that they need.
Dr. Maria van Kerkhove from Today with Claire Byrne. And on Morning Ireland, saying goodbye to the Derry Girls.
Yeah, the maze was the focal point of a troubled peace process.
It's all anyone ever bangs on about.
We lived on the edge back then. We were young, wild.
And that, of course, was the trailer for Series 3 of Derry Girls. The final hour-long Derry Girls, of course, aired last night on Channel 4. Creator and writer Lisa McGee rounded out each character for one last hurrah against a backdrop, once again, of the Troubles and the vote on the Good Friday Agreement. As throughout this third series, there are laughs aplenty from the girls, the wee English lad and their families, and again, some surprising guest appearances. Pauline Moore, one of the hosts of the Talking Derry Girls podcast, is on the line. Hello, Pauline.
Good morning, Mary. How are you?
Now, of course, the series ended on Tuesday night with the final episode, the final half hour episode.
Yeah.
It ended very sadly with Claire's dad's death. But then we had the hour long last night, the hour long special. Did Lisa McGee pull it off? Did she pull off the perfect ending?
I think she did. I think without any doubt. And Dave Stephen, you know, looking at the Twitter feeds and things last night, just as it finished, I think people who were a bit worried with the ending of the end of very end of the series with the funeral were a bit concerned where could it go, but she did lift it. I think it just was a perfect end and brought it all together, and having that space of a year as well, just to, you know, coming up to the Good Friday Agreement, a time of change, a time, first time that they all got to vote, the girls. So you know, I think it was I think she did. She did. Yeah. She pulled it off perfectly.
It was an amazing balancing act between the funny and the serious and the backdrop of the vote on the Good Friday Agreement. Pat Stacey in The Independent this morning said that, that last night's special was full of gems. What were the gems for you?
Oh, gosh. I think probably just even right from the opening, just that sort of flash to all bits of, from all the different programmes, just that and over the music and Orla going into the Guildhall and a place I know really well from working, you know, in the radio there and covering council meetings and things and dancing around and getting her vote. I think that just set the tone for the whole thing. There are gems for me as well, like, you know, this will change our lives, the whole Good Friday Agreement. And you see Ma Mary, the thing that's going to change her life is a new microwave oven. So it's that sort of play of the domestic and the big questions being asked. And also just the whole for a focus on falling out and disagreement and a sort of more serious Michelle that we saw that we because she has a she we discovered has a brother who, you know, will be released from prison as a part of the Good Friday Agreement. So there was disagreements, there was compromise, there was making up again. So I think just the whole thing just came together so well.
Pauline Moore, host of the Talking Derry Girls podcast for Morning Ireland with Mary Wilson. And in the morning, Ryan Tuberty was talking about abandoned pets, bird catching and the business end of domestic animals in his chat with Elise O'Byrne.
Well, I am a veterinary surgeon at the DSPCA.
Ah.
Yes.
Is that do you kind of aspire to such a thing from an early age or does it creep up on you?
Actually, in my case, absolutely not. I had no interest in veterinary at all. I started off not knowing what I wanted to do. I ended up doing a science degree in Trinity first.
Yes.
I specialised in zoology.
So we were heading towards the...
David Attenborough territory. That's what I had in my head.
Okay. In what sense?
Just that kind of sense of adventure. And I did a bit of bird catching in Indonesia for a couple of months. And
definitely going to talk about that in a second. Keep going. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I actually, because I do play a bit of rugby, I wanted to have a job that was a bit more practical and I could stay in Ireland for. And so I started looking about something else I could do with animals. And I saw a bit of practice with a vet down in Waterford. And from there, I said, I think this could be something for me. Yeah.
Okay. You got and you realized this is where I want to be going.
Yeah.
Now, bird catching in Indonesia.
Yeah.
Because when I read about you and it said bird catching, I thought I got the pen out. I said, that's a typo. She meant bird watching. And so I really did. I thought there's something wrong with bird. I've never heard of bird catching.
Yeah. So it was part of Trinity Zoology, basically looking for a new bird species out there along the islands in the Wakatobi region. So I was part of a research group out there.
We were fascinating.
Four in the morning. You set up these big mist nets. They kind of look like badminton nets.
Yes.
And the birds get up, you play the bird song and they'll come and then you catch them and you ring them, measure them, do some UV light on them and take all the information down. And it was very interesting.
You play the bird song?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
So you play their song on, you play the song that they're used to basically singing and it attracts them to the area. And so that's, if you're looking for a specific type of bird, that's one way of kind of getting them.
What are you playing it on?
A radio.
Just lash it up on Bluetooth, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And in the, they kind of go, oh, the gang's up. Like, let's go and join the others.
Exactly.
There's no one there. They're caught in a net then.
Caught in a net,
but no cruelty. It's all...
No, and we did have a specialised person who's only able to take them out of the net because it's very delicate. You have to be really delicate with them.
Yeah.
And so once we do that, it's really, really quick measurements and then back out.
They're away. Do you discover new species of birds?
That must be really
interesting.
Yeah, I was only part of it for a certain amount of time. But the result of the study was that they did find another species of bird. Yeah.
Do they name them then as well?
They do those Latin names.
Do they?
Yeah.
Does the person who catches it get the name? You know the way, or we were talking about this recently, like it could be an asteroid or it could be a plant, but you can name them after somebody you admire or somebody you love or yourself.
Yeah, I think you can do whatever you want. I don't know what the rules are about it, but that was recent. So recently discovered new species.
Interesting. So you did that for 4 months.
Yeah.
Bird catching.
Yeah.
Up at 4 a.m.
Up at 4 a.m. in the jungle. Yeah, in a really remote village called Labunda Bunda. And so I was wandering around the forest there for a good while.
So you had your Attenborough moment, really. That sounds
that was my Attenborough moment.
But you came back and you studied your veterinary and you finished it out, I should say. And now you're working with the DSPCA.
Now I'm working with the DSPCA, which is Ireland's oldest and largest animal welfare charity. So I am kept busy.
What's keeping you busy these days?
Everything. So it's a great place, but it's so busy at this time of year because you have the wildlife getting born at the moment. We have ducklings, foxes coming in. We have kitten season upon us now. So we are getting, I think in 3 days last week, we got maybe 40 kittens in.
What? Kitten season?
Kitten season,
what does that mean? I thought kittens were being born all year round. I'm not being smart.
You're right.
Is there a season?
Kind of a kitten season. Okay. So we're basically, kittens can get born out all year round. Yeah. But at the moment, it's the most likely time for, it's kind of the natural time for cats to
have
kittens.
Like lambing for cats.
Exactly, lambing for cats, yeah. So that's very busy because we kind of get all sorts of kittens and different
complications.
Yeah, you know, some they're feral or wild or they've been abandoned, and so they can be anything from 1 or 2 days old to, you know, a full 12-week old kittens.
And Ryan asked about the abandoned animals' fate after they go to the DSPCA.
Why do I have this kind of 80s, 90s horrible feeling about cats and dogs' homes, that if they don't get chosen after a month, they get put down? Are animals put? No, thank God, you just went immediately. No, stop talking. Stop words coming out of your mouth immediately.
No,
okay, come on, tell me.
Well, see how the shelter works is we get animals in all states. So unfortunately, you know, neglected, strays, and cruelty cases at times, and they come in through the veterinary department. We assess them all. Some need a lot of medical attention, and some don't need much. Mm-hmm. And then from there, once they have the rehabilitation done, off they go to rehoming. And from there, we have a different team of people who do the adoptions and the fostering. And then their job is to find the home that suits them and find the person that suits the animal. And
so sometimes it's a matchup.
It's a matchup, and sometimes it takes time. It's not, you know, it doesn't happen immediately. But we do rehome about 2,500 animals a year.
All when you say animals, is that cats and dogs, or is it all sorts? I mean, does it go down to the exotica then?
It does, yeah. Now, the majority, I have to say, is cats and dogs, but we do have terrapins, and we had a corn snake in last week. We've had some birds, some parrots in as well. So it's a variety, but it is the majority of cats and dogs, and rabbits and guinea pigs as well.
Obviously, I'm going to alight on the corn snake. What I'm curious to know, who has the courage to hand it in and say, look what I found, or pick it up, or how do you handle it?
I don't know where it's the problem with the kind of reptile side of things is that usually they end up on our doorstep because the husbandry isn't very good. So people get them maybe on the internet and they don't know how to look after them. Or the animal might get a little bit too big, and unfortunately we find them dumped in the wild, which is, they can't survive in the wild. Or we find terrapins dumped in the rivers, and they're obviously cold-blooded, so they will not survive with Irish weather, and then they come into us.
Do you think people who are abandoning terrapins think that they're not being that bad by putting them in water, regardless of the class of water, that they think, I don't really want it, I'm just going to put it here and off you go? Or do you think there's...
I hope so. I think that's best case scenario if they're just...
That's erring on the side of kindness to the person.
If they're just setting them free,
Yeah, I think that maybe that's what they're thinking.
Yeah.
But actually...
Yeah, no, it's not the environment
for them.
It is a death sentence, yeah. And it's a slow death sentence, so...
Please don't do it.
Don't do that. And if you're thinking of getting any sort of reptile, make sure that you do your research because they're very complicated.
Do you guys in the DSPCA, when you're in the canteen shooting the breeze and having a coffee, think, how are some people so thick when it comes to taking on an animal they simply can't handle, and they keep coming back to you with, oh, I didn't realise this kitten was going to become a cat. I didn't realise the terrapin was going to become the size of a turtle or whatever it might be. Do you kind of think, lads, just do a bit of basic homework?
Yeah, I guess at times I do. I think
you're too diplomatic and polite to agree with me, but I suspect there's a bit of that.
There is. One particular case, we had a dog return to us because it was going to the toilet too much. And that was one that I was just thinking to myself, surely that's an obvious thing that's going to happen when you get an animal. But yeah. I do, like you said, do that little bit of research. It makes a massive difference if you're thinking of getting an animal to know what's expected in terms of time, care, money, and the breed you're getting, and what sort of health issues that breed might have, because it is a huge responsibility taking it into your life. Huge. And I kind of would expect that a little bit of research is done, or you can even talk to a vet before you're thinking of getting an animal to find one that suits you.
Yeah.
And with the shelter, that is a really good option, because we have people matching you up already, which, you know, kind of talks you through that process a little bit more, so you have a little bit more communication and understanding of what you're getting into.
Bit of prep,
exactly.
Did you, you know, when you think of the snake, the terrapins, and the parrots? Again, I'm going with the more peculiar and less usual creatures that you'd be dealing with. Are they easy to rehome or rehouse?
Not as easy as the usual cats and dogs,
which we'll get to in a second.
Yeah. Because it does take somebody who knows the animal husbandry and has the setups of the tanks at the right temperature and especially the right diet for them. They need a balanced diet, and there's a lot less people who are educated, I suppose, in knowing how to look after those animals. But the people who are excellent.
Okay,
so when we find a good home, they really go to the best of the best.
You'd have a database and go, okay, terrapin, we know so-and-so might be inclined to take that.
Yeah.
And if it's a bird, you'll say, well, look, that person may for a while, if not forever.
Exactly. That's where my zoology degree comes in handy. I go back to I have a hub in Trinity that I go and ask the bird people or the bat people or the badger people, and they can direct me in the right direction to try find a home for some of the lost creatures.
Lost creatures of the world.
And Ryan asked Elise about those pandemic pets.
Elise, let me ask you about cats and dogs, and especially post-pandemic, because there was a lot of talk of people saying, I need a dog. I thought about it for a little while, to be honest with you, and I'm kind of glad I didn't, because, you know, if I had to go to Galway yesterday, I'd have to be searching around for people to mind the dog for, and all this sort of thing. So it would have been a short-term fix in some ways, but long-term, it wouldn't have been fair. Mm-hmm. So tell me about people who did get the cats and dogs and kind of don't want them anymore. Mm-hmm. And not even that they don't want them, because not everyone is that cold about it, but simply can't have them anymore.
Mm.
Has that shown up in the last few months?
It has shown up in different ways. I personally haven't seen that many animals being surrendered, but have seen a little bit more behavioural issues. So animals that people maybe that got animals when they were puppies and they didn't have the opportunity to do the training. And now the animal is one year old, 18 months, 2 years old, and starting to just have a few more behavioural issues than it would have previously. So that's one thing I'm noticing. Also noticing that the animals that I'm seeing sometimes have a little bit more advanced medical issues, because during that period they weren't taken to the vet. So seeing a lot of older animals sometimes being abandoned now, which is not really what you have been hearing.
Your loyal friend?
Unfortunately,
it has a disloyal ending, really, by the owners.
Yeah, well, I suppose you never know what's going on with people's lives or what circumstances they're in. But yeah, we have seen a few older animals being left in. I haven't seen the COVID craze of getting, you know.
Okay, well, that's good. Good
it
to
is
hear, because
I
kind of got a sense that about the place that was the case. But you're certainly not in the DSPCA.
Not in the DSPCA, no.
Elise O'Byrne from the Ryan Tuberty Show. And back to the live line. After Leanne's story about travelling abroad to Turkey for gastric sleeve surgery, Brendan called Katie with his experience of travelling for dental work.
I went to Kusasi.
In Turkey as well, yeah.
Yeah.
And what did you get done?
I got 12 implants and 20 crowns.
12 implants and 20 crowns or 28 crowns?
28 crowns.
28 crowns. A massive amount of work, Brendan. What, do you mind me asking, did you pay for that?
Now, I paid 7,000 for the work.
Right.
And now that didn't include flights and accommodation.
Okay, but how long were you out there getting that done?
Well, I went 7 days the first time in March, end of March, or the end of April last year, I beg your pardon, and I got the teeth, I had 7 red teeth remaining. Mm-hmm. And they pulled out them teeth and they implanted the implants into my jaw the same day.
Right. So, I mean, again, I mean, it's not gastric surgery, but it's a fairly big, that's a fairly big, I would have thought quite high risk procedure, is it?
Well, you see, Katie, the problem here is I'd done 6 months research on this before I went out.
Yeah. So were you looking for quotes for that here?
I was looking, within the 6 months, I was researching different clinics, the type of clinic, the quality of the clinic. Of course, the price was important as well.
Right.
But in addition, what I had to research most was the quality of implant and would my body reject them?
Yeah.
So I found that titanium implants are the most popular and 99.9% of the population accept them anyway.
And can I ask you, if you had to get those implants, that particular type of implant here and the crowns you got as well, how much would that have cost you here?
€36,000.
€36,000?
Yes.
And you say you got it done for 7,000 in Turkey?
Yeah. Now, the clinic I linked up with, there was an Irish girl as a patient coordinator who works out there for the clinic.
Okay, so obviously they have a lot of Irish clients.
They have. Now, where I work, the establishment I work in Ireland, 5 of my work colleagues have went since I returned and got their work done with their teeth, crowns or implants, whatever procedures needed, and they've all come back with the same high-quality work, no side effects, no after effects, no nothing.
And was that incredibly painful, Brendan?
More uncomfortable.
Getting 12 implants is just uncomfortable.
Well, you see, what they done was I got knocked out for it. I was put under a general anaesthetic.
Yeah.
And when I woke up, they had a proper recovery room with a monitor on me and a nurse sitting beside me when I came around.
Go on.
No, they gave me painkilling relief and injected into me, and also gave me prescription for a full course of weeks of Augmentine to prevent any infections.
And what was going on with you that you needed all those implants? Were they just?
I spent years overseas with the military, mm-hmm. and bad dental hygiene in these foreign countries and everything else. And my teeth just went neglected over the years. Mm-hmm. But I had to get an X-ray, a 3D X-ray done in Ireland before I went, and to see was the density of bone good enough to take implants.
Right.
And when I arrived in the clinic to meet the consultant on the Saturday, they explained to me exactly what had been done, the tour of the clinic, showed me the quality of the treatment rooms, how clean they were. I went home in the morning, I was knocked out, and I woke up with all these implants in.
And you must look gorgeous now, do you, Brendan?
Well, I don't want to be too vain, but my teeth look good, that's all I can say.
That's Brendan on the live line with Katie Hannon. And in the morning, it's a bit of a buzzword at the moment, rewilding. So what does it mean? Randall Plunkett, Baron of Dunsany, and Pádraig Fógarty of the Irish Wildlife Trust. We're talking to Claire Byrne.
Pádraig, I'm going to start with you because I want to just get a handle on what this is, because there is that dilemma where people think that they know what rewilding is, but they're not quite sure. Can you just define it for us?
Yeah, so there has been a lot of confusion about it. But it's important to note that last year, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature published a paper supported by the scientific community that identified rewilding as extremely important as part of our response to the climate and biodiversity emergency. So really what we want to do, what we want to get out of rewilding is the restoration of our natural ecosystems. Now, this is important because in Ireland, we don't have any natural ecosystems. We've basically destroyed them all. And this matters because our land at the moment...
Say that again? We've destroyed them all?
Pretty much, yes. Our native forests are about 1% of our land. We don't have any healthy bogs. Our seas have basically been destroyed and overfished from bottom trawling. So the human pressure in Ireland is more or less 100%. And rewilding is a chance to reverse that damage.
Mm-hmm. And our other guest, Randall, and I know you know Randall well, is using part of your estate, Randall. You're very welcome. Thank you for being with
us. Thank you for having me.
So this... estate was used in its entirety for agriculture, was it?
Pretty much, yeah. It was one of the largest farms in the country for the longest period of time. My great relatives were pioneers in creating sort of the modern agricultural structures that we have today. There was at one point more than 1,000 cattle here at the beginning of the century. So we were very much on the cutting edge of industrial agriculture. But now times have changed. Climate change is the fight of our time. Mm-hmm. And we are trying to be on the cutting edge of the next transformation, if you like.
So you inherited how long ago? About 10 years ago?
A bit more than that, yeah, about 10 years ago.
And did you make the decision straight away that you would do this?
Pretty much, yeah.
So tell me about that, because it's not an easy conversion to make, I'm sure.
No, and I had quite a few awkward conversations, I'll tell you. But the thing was, is that part of my job here has always been to preserve history. To preserve the buildings, preserve the people's contributions to history here. And one thing that I think has been neglected largely in the past was how important our nature is to our culture. You know, this is a country that celebrates its language, celebrates its history, but we're not celebrating our nature, and we would have very little without our nature. It was nature that fed us, it's nature that will give us a future.
And when you talk about awkward conversations, were they family conversations or do they go beyond that?
Well, let's just say I got called idiot a lot. Mm-hmm. the thing is like this is a new idea. This at the time was quite a new idea. And I didn't really have a name for it because rewilding was a term that got popular a few years ago. But 10, 11 years ago, it wasn't really a buzzword. So we called it nature conservation at the time. But nature conservation isn't a very sexy term. Rewilding is far more sexy.
Yeah, and you see,
looks better on a t-shirt.
The reason why people are so uncomfortable with this is because you can't make money from rewilding your land.
No, not in this country. And the problem is that long-term thinking, you can't base our future on what you get today. And the problem is that this is something that has to happen all the way around the world. The UN has said that we need to rewild an area the size of China to combat some of the problems we're having. Now, what is Ireland doing about that? Because everybody needs to do something. Ireland's doing very little. They're trying. We're not going to discount that there's efforts being made, but they're not enough. Mm-hmm. So it's gotten to the point where I myself said it's time to either stop complaining and do something. So I did.
And not everybody is happy about this. I read in an interview that you did about a year ago that you have faced some confrontation, to put it mildly, in the local area.
There has always been problems. But the thing is with this sort of idea, any changing of a paradigm is always going to create a knee-jerk reaction. But this is something that's very natural. This is something that we need to celebrate, something that we need to endorse, because this is our culture. This is part of our heritage. And more than that, it's part of our future. And if we don't do anything now, it doesn't matter that there's no money today. There won't be anything tomorrow, because this is a largely agricultural country. We're very dependent on the climate. And one season where there's no rain, most of the farming is going to be destroyed in this country. So we need to plan ahead. And rewilding is one tool that we can use to try and offset that. And there's no point blaming the Chinese or blaming the Russians or blaming the Americans. What do we do in this country is what we have to start with, and then the rest will follow.
And Pádraig Foley explained what we can do as individuals.
Yes, I think the most important way we can contribute to it is raising our voice about it, and particularly making it a more political issue. Obviously, we can rewild our gardens and our public spaces in towns and cities, and that's valuable and important. But we have to recognise that the seriousness of the ecological crisis that we have in Ireland, it's not just important for, you know, wildlife and butterflies. It's important to people. It's absolutely crucial for the future of our civilization. Rewilding is so important because it gives us hope that we can recover. Nature is more or less waiting in the wings if we can give us some time and space. But we have great difficulty in Ireland giving wild nature any space, never mind time.
Landowners have to eat, and the people who rely on the land for their income, they have to eat too. So should we be encouraging people by rewarding them financially for doing what Randall has done.
Yeah, absolutely. This is crucial part of the jigsaw. At the moment, we spend billions in subsidies, which are mostly damaging to nature. So we could redirect those subsidies to encourage landowners to help to restore native forests, to restore bogs, to reflood land for rivers, for instance. So paying farmers for these things is something that we have to do. And I should say, it's not a case that we exclusively need to rewild the entire country. High nature value farming is an important part of this as well. Farming is an important part of our culture, and that should go hand in hand with
What's
rewilding.
What's high nature value farming?
So it's basically producing food in a way that doesn't destroy nature. At the moment, we have an agricultural system that produces greenhouse gases, is disastrous for biodiversity and pollutes our waterways. So basically farming in a way that doesn't involve chemicals and works with nature.
Borg Foley and Randall Plunkett from Today with Claire Byrne. And on the Ray Darcy Show, an email that was Father Ted stuff, a motorised bar stool.
Now, we got an email into ray@rte.ie from Madeleine Flint. You've heard her name mentioned already. And she says, "Hello, Ray. I'm the proud owner of my beloved late husband's motorised bar stool." You heard me correctly. Motorised bar stool, which featured on Evening Extra in March of 1988. And 30 years later on RTE Today with Dahi and Maura. The reason I'm getting in touch with your programme is I'm doing a trip from a little village called Walsh Island in County Offaly to Arranmore Island on the 9th and 10th of June, along with a few Honda 50 enthusiasts. We are trying to raise money for Our Lady's Hospital, Crumlin. It's 189 miles and we will be going through a few towns and villages and hopefully doing a bucket collection along the way. It's old school. It's Father Ted stuff. Hopefully we will get a few people to come out and wave us on our way. That's where you come in. You can help to give us a little bit of publicity. Thank you very much, Madeleine Flint. And Madeleine joins us on the line. How are you doing, Madeleine?
Not too bad, Ray. How are you?
Madeleine.
I've been called everything. Maddie, you name it, I've been called it.
Right. What do you prefer yourself?
I honestly don't mind.
Okay. Good to talk to you. And it's Walsh Island as opposed to Walsh's Island.
It's actually Walsh Island, yeah. Yes, that's it.
And as far as I can see from the map, it isn't an island.
Well, it's not an island surrounded by water, but we are surrounded by bog.
Oh, I see. Right, so it's a bog island.
Yeah, you could call it that.
And are you born and bred in Walsh Island?
Born and bred in it. Yes, I am indeed.
Right. I was looking at the clip from Evening Extra 1988 and Eamon O'Murray is the reporter, the late Eamon O'Murray.
He is, yeah.
And he spoke to your then husband, Noel Duffy, the late Noel Duffy as well. So tell us a bit about the motorised bar stool and Noel himself. So,
yeah.
When did you meet Noel? Did you meet him locally? Was he a Walsh Island man?
He was a Walsh Island man, and I think I was mad about him since I was probably six. I always fancied him, and like you know, we were childhood sweethearts, and we went out together. Would you believe it? For nearly 15 years.
Right.
I was 30 years of age when we got married.
Yeah,
and that was basically he was a biker, and I got involved with the bikes with him, and he had lots of friends with bikes. And the 1988, I wasn't actually married to him; I was engaged to him. I think
we must have had the longest engagement.
Okay. No, you're fine.
yeah.
We must have had the longest engagement. I think we were engaged for 15 years.
Right, and he was fascinated by engines of all descriptions.
Loved engines, and had a garage shed out the back, and he was in it, but like there was a certain time there that I'd go out and he wouldn't let me in. He says, "No, I'm doing something, I'm busy, can you come back?" or whatever like that. So I'd go into the house, but about 2 months later anyway, he comes out this Sunday morning and he said to us, "Come out and have a look at this." And lo and behold, he had the bar stool with a Honda 50 engine in it, and he drove it around the yard, and we just were looking at it. We were flabbergasted, like, this is how the heck.
And it sounds like an ocean that happened over a few pints.
It did.
Go on.
There was Alan Besson and Huck O'Brady and Davy Brady and the whole lot of them, and Gerard Brady as well, another lad, and they're all bikers. I mean, every Sunday we'd head off on the bikes and coming back, and they talk about nothing else, only engines and pistons and rev limiters. And I think that was my actual nickname, the rev limiter. And
I won't ask.
It's probably best you don't.
Here's the rev limiter now.
Yeah, he was always the one that stopped all the fun, seemingly. But this was the chat that was going on all the time, and this thing said about you could put an engine into anything, and Noel says definitely you could. So, like, the pub we were in was the local pub here in Welsh Island. It was Mahan's.
Yeah.
And the actual stools we were sitting on is one of the stools. That's right. The stool that he got.
So he must have just, Noel must have said then, I could put an engine into this bar stool, for example.
He did, but he didn't tell me too much about it. He probably spoke to the boys, but it kind of was like, we'll try this to see how we get on. And if it works, we'll tell the world. And if it doesn't, we'll say
But it worked.
It did, absolutely.
Do you want to? Do you mind if we play a bit of Noel?
Because I love it. I think it's brilliant. He'd be very, very proud himself.
So they were chatting about it, and they were chatting about the speed and everything, and that's the way the chat was going. So we'll go back to the two lads, Eamon and Noel, chatting about the motorised bar stool at the bar.
What speed would you do it?
I reckon it would do about 35 miles an hour, but I wouldn't like to be sitting on it at the time.
But certainly not. I mean, not around here.
If you want to have a go, I have fair enough, but I don't think I'd chance it.
Well, I had a go at Nolan. One of the things I notice about it is that there's no brakes in it.
But whoever had brakes in a bar stool?
No wiser words were said. Who'd be having brakes on a bar stool? He'd a dry sense of humour, Noel.
He had, yes, indeed. He was very good that way.
Yeah. And I suppose his passion was the death of him in the end.
Yes, that's the truth. We had a quad and a trike. We had a few motorbikes as well. And we lived in the middle of the bog, as I said. And we used to go down to the bog, down the back garden of his place. And he went in the trike. And I was to go with him this particular day in the quad, but I didn't because I was working and I kind of was doing housework at the weekends and trying to get as much done so I could go to work Monday to Friday. Mm. But I didn't go. But he lost his life down there that evening.
Right. What age was he, Madeline?
He was 36.
Right.
Madeline Flint on The Ray D'Arcy Show. And back to Liveline. After Leanne called Katie to talk about her gastric bypass, Carla also called Katie to talk about her dramatic weight loss.
I thought that gastric bypass surgery was the only way that I could lose weight, but I've actually managed to lose 13 stone in the last, in 14 months. Just with a traditional walking weight loss program called Body Slims, and that's been fantastic.
So, say that again. You've lost, did you say 13 stone?
13 stone in 14 months, yeah.
You've been losing over a stone a month?
No, just under a stone a month.
Just under a stone a month, sorry, in 14 months, yes.
In 14 months.
That's astonishing, Carla. I mean, in fairness, it must take unbelievable commitment, does it?
To be honest with you, the first thing that I did was fixed my head. 10 years ago, my GP told me when I went to him with binge eating disorder that he said, when you fix the head, the weight will just fall off. I did therapy, which I think is the most important part of it. I fixed my head because my obesity was a symptom of how I was feeling and my negative self-talk. So I decided that I went back to therapy. I did the therapy for food addiction, and then I started a Body Slims program January 2020. And within 14 months, then I lost 13 stone.
And was this something that you, a lifelong issue for you, Carla?
Absolutely. I have been overweight or obese my entire life. I've tried every one of the traditional diet programs, like you name it, I've done it. I've lost 6 stone before, put it back on again, lost another 6 stone, put it back on again, because I never addressed what was going on inside me, you know, with my head. And when I did that, I felt finally committed and ready to do it. And honestly, I wouldn't say it was easy, but it was simple. And that's one of the wonderful things about the program that I did. But it was gave you a calorie controlled diet, walking 1 hour every single day, and that's it. That's all I had to do. And I just had to do it consistently. I think that's the most important aspect, is to be consistent.
It's every day. You have to get out there every day and you have to stick with this
day.
With this calorie. And the sheer scale of what you have lost in terms of your body weight is...
I share my story on Instagram and YouTube, and my handle is half of Carla because I lost over half my body weight. So I share everything from day one there, how I did it and what I did. And I'm actually currently losing a little bit of weight at the moment because I just had a baby. So,
congratulations.
Getting back on. Thank you very much.
And you don't have any fears now, because as you say, you had a lifelong of losing weight, putting it back on, you know, having this issue. You have no fears that you're going to regain this weight that you've lost now?
Absolutely not. I know now that I've addressed the issues that caused me to become obese, because obesity, I believe, is a symptom of something else that's going on. I was using food as a methodology of escape. It was an addiction, similar to drugs, alcohol. It's an escape, you know, from whatever situation that's going on. And I managed now to address that, to deal with the trauma that I was experiencing. And from that, I was then able to use, as I said, the Body Slims program, which was what I call my roadmap to weight loss. So I followed that, and I was, 13 months later, here, or 14 months later, I was, you know, went from a size 24, 26 to a size 8 to 10. And I couldn't be any healthier. You know, like my cardio fitness levels, like I was always the obese, the fat friend. You know, I could never shop in a regular store. Like I always had to get a seatbelt extender on a plane. All of that's gone now. I have the sense of freedom, a sense of relief. I basically feel like I unzipped myself and walked out.
That's Carla on the live line with Katie Hannon. And on today with Claire Byrne, recognising the signs of ovarian cancer.
Ireland has one of the highest death rates from ovarian cancer in Europe, and around 400 women are diagnosed with ovarian cancer each year in this country. Despite this, though, 79% of women in Ireland aren't confident that they'd notice a symptom of the cancer. Well, joining me to discuss the signs, the symptoms and the treatment for ovarian cancer is Donal Brennan, who's Professor of Gynaecological Oncology and Academic Lead of the UCD Gynaecological Oncology Group. You're very welcome. Thank you for coming in. As I was saying to you when you were walking in, we have many questions, but you probably aren't surprised that we don't know what to look out for when it comes to ovarian cancer, because the symptoms might be the types of things that women experience, discomfort in some cases, normally, regularly, and don't pay any heed to.
Exactly, Claire, and thank you for having me. The symptoms for ovarian cancer are vague, and that's the problem, and they're very common. And that's why we've developed this campaign with the Irish National Gynae Oncology Research Group called the BEAT campaign, which is to try and remind people about these symptoms.
Mm-hmm. And you'll explain that to us, B-E-A-A-T.
So B-E-A-T, so B is for bloating, which you know happens quite a lot. But what we really want to know about is people have persistent bloating for more than 3 weeks, almost constantly. That's really a sign that persistent bloating is something that needs to be investigated and not always put down to things like irritable bowel syndrome and things like that. The second is abdominal pain. The third is feeling full earlier, eating less. And that's something that a lot of patients tell me about and they remember beforehand. And then the last thing is changes in toilet habit, whether that be changes in bowel habit or changes in bladder habit as well.
Mm-hmm. You see, you can, just as you're talking, you can imagine that people are going, I have irritable bowel. Yeah. This is what I have. I know it myself.
So I think that's why it's a persistence of symptoms, or if somebody feels that there's a change in their own body.
Professor Donal Brennan from Today with Claire Byrne. And that's it for Playback Daily. So mind yourself till next time.